We come to the 13th presentation for this year. The investigation is the Parayana, which is the way across. It's the higher way. What it is higher than, it is higher than the cycle of nature. That the cycle of nature has space-time for our world for tens of thousands of years, and for millions of years before that, and for billions of years before that, rooted in a natural cycle, which in more recent millions of years has become four seasons for the temperate areas of the planet. And so the quality of four seasons becomes a constituent part of human culture, especially over the last several hundred thousand years, and certainly there by the time that Homo erectus 2 million years ago was able to travel enormous distances on the planet, usually confined to the continent of Africa, but spreading eventually out of Africa and going very far afield in terms of the Eurasian continent in what is today Ethiopia, Lake Turkana area, a skeleton of a Homo erectus young man, probably in his late teens, was discovered, and there is a beautiful monograph on it academically by Richard M. Leakey, the son of Mary and L.S.B. Leakey, one of the sons. And he was almost 6 feet tall and had the skeletal structure of a track star and lived some almost 2 million years ago. So that the hominid clad, as it were, is very, very ancient, and we go back millions of years in layers, in stages before that. And all of this comes into a mysterious quality when our particular species begins to refine itself out of what apparently were a pair of hominid precursors to us, the Neanderthal, Homo Neanderthalis, and a newly discovered hominid species called Denisova from the cave at Denisova in the Siberian part of Russia. And these two had split from each other apparently hundreds of thousands of years before there was any development of our particular refinement of the Homo species, and that is before Homo sapiens came into play about 200,000 years ago, the Denisovian population of hominids and the Neanderthals had split off some 100 or 200,000 years before then, and of course go back hundreds of thousands of years in a precursor hominid species, so that we have been prepared for a very long time, but only recently discovered. No one knew anything about ancient man until 1856, when Neanderthal in the Neander River Valley, a skeleton was found and eventually became the Neanderthal man. And of course, this was an individual that was crippled by arthritic conditions. And so Neanderthals got the stereotype of the caveman who is hunched over and obviously wearing animal skins and carrying a club and dragging a mate by the hair into the cave. And that this somehow was the kind of Darwinian look at the primitive, bestial, animal nature of man. And this is not true at all. There are human beings all over the planet that have DNA, and that DNA includes segments from Neanderthal ancestors who mated with Homo sapien ancestors. Not only tens, but hundreds, a couple hundred thousand years ago. So that it's imperative for us to begin to learn that everything is new in the sense that it is a new past. It is a new past on every level of comprehension that you can imagine and on many levels of encompassing that you cannot imagine because they're not imaginable, but they are creatable by refinement, by learning. And so the quality of civilization from here on forward, from here on out, is a learning civilization, which includes, as a tuning fork, the new past and the future. And by doing an H.G. Wells convolution of that ratio, we say the future and the new past. The future and the new past are given what glibly is called a quantum entanglement now by the continuity of understanding time as a dimension. Without understanding time as the first dimension, we do not begin with the right foot on any kind of a path, much less discovering that the path is within a field and that there are several fields in the cosmos. And so it isn't a path so much, but it's a way. And I use the Sanskrit word for way as jnana, because the first time that jnana was brought into play as given a way was by the historical Buddha in several of his deliverances in his presentations 2,500 years ago. And one of them was a set of 16 called at that time the Parayana as a set, as a harmonic of these 16. And out of this came the understanding by the historical Buddha, because of very much a refined, high Dharma way, that there is a unit, there is an atom of thought by which thought operates. And that atomic structure of thought is called a citta, C-I-T-T-A in Sanskrit, a citta. And that there is such a thing that opens up the entire continuity of time to a mind, a symbolic thought structure that is able to work with, utilize, create with, remember with a bodhicitta, the moment, the atom of thought that there is a freedom, an enlightenment, whereby one can now begin to have a different quality of mind, a different quality of the structure of symbolic thought, and that the difference is that the invisible now becomes seeable, not in terms of perception, not in terms of perception, even integral to conception, but that one sees through like a window, like an open doorway, like a gate. One sees through to a vision in terms of the continuity of time, where the future and the new past are not severed by a fictitious present. There is no present moment. And by understanding that, the bodhicitta becomes capable of generating the thought that there is a freedom completely, because there are dimensions beyond. There are dimensions beyond the four dimensions, like the four seasons of nature. And that quality, in one of the most powerful 21st century theories of cosmology, in string theory, is called quintessence. And that quintessence is the scientific theoretical name now for the fifth dimension, like the movable thumb that allows for man at last as a species to have the creative hand, the remembering calibration by which he, she, they can be free for the first time in this world, really, truly, high dharmically free. It is difficult at this particular time, because it is emerging, the British phrase is pell-mell. It is coming out like a gusher. And there is no way to utilize it whatsoever. It's just a gusher. We're presenting the way, the parayana, by which one can begin to see that this gusher has not only usable energy, but it has usable vision. It has the resonances and the sets of resonances and the harmonic, analytic, and the aesthetic beauty of the future and the new past, of the continuity of civilization as being the flower, the rose, the lotus of a humane civilization where men and women participate tuned together in the sense that they are an entangled gender pairedness that has its differentiation of not just two genders, but of many qualities of genders. And this comes out just the last day or so on the web, in the net. This is the Daily Galaxy, and this is March 28th of 2014. And it reads here, quantum vacuum powers the dark energy driving our universe. Quantum energy powers the dark energy, but it's quantum vacuum powers the dark energy driving our universe. The energy can be and needs to be understood as time. That is not a dark energy. It is a high dharma time that is the dynamic of the way in which that gusher occurs, and that gusher occurs constantly, including what glibly is called the Big Bang, and that the universe has a dynamis. It has a dynamic, and the dynamic has a creativity to it. And the creativity is not some kind of made up or hocus pocus, but its creativeness is that once time emerges spontaneously as a dimension from a zero field of nature. Now, a zero field is a perfect zero field, and the term vacuum refers to something that is reduced so far that one can not detect analytically any further down the line. And we have come by late March of 2014 to be able to peer analytically to one trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second in clock time. When you write that down, you write 10 with 32 zeros. 10 to the 32nd power. We can analytically refine that far. And when we do, and it was just released by the Harvard Smithsonian Investigation Astronomical Cosmological Crew, that at that split second of a split second of a split second, we're talking about splits of trillionths, there were already gravity waves. And the gravity waves have a special analytic shapedness that is called the B mode. And the B mode is that of a pinwheel. So that when time comes into play spontaneously, from a zero field more perfect than a vacuum, it brings with it into the now zero field become an emergence gateway, an emergence portal, an emergence into a universe that instantly, because now there is time, no matter that it's a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, nevertheless, there is time, and it instantly creates the blossoming of three-dimensional space. And that three-dimensional space is intimately connected with time as a, quote, dark energy, and the space becomes a dark matter, quote, unquote. So that when one looks at early 20th century developments of Einstein's relativity concerning space-time as a fabric, and that its curvature is all about gravitation, of gravity, or of the development almost concurrently of what became quantum mechanics, one begins to understand. We are approaching April 1st, 2014, getting very close to a no fooling me day. No fool's day. Just a few days away. We have to understand that it is profound. It is the profundity of the profound, as Lao Tzu says. And so it is a mystery within a mystery within a mystery that is encompassed by a silence, yet sound can be heard out of that. And that the first wave resonance of that is gravitation. Gravity waves, and what do? They integrate. They pull together. But they pull together in such a way that while they spontaneously begin the integral of pulling together, they also instantly blossom a differential, which is the pinwheel B mode structuring, so that one has a cosmos which has an integral universe being born and birthed and conceived and fertilized by a differential quality that shows instantly that spontaneity has a child, which is instantaneousness. And so one has to be not only quick on the draw, one has to understand that you can't outdraw the spontaneous, and that it would be fool's errand. April Fool, no kidding. You cannot outdraw spontaneity. And when spontaneity occurs, as we will see, it doesn't just dwarf the universe. It celebrates the incredible exclamation point that the universe occurs and will have phenomenality because of the integral. It will have existentiality because of that integral. It will have a quality that leads to the development and developments and developments that finally there is a species like Homo sapiens sapiens, who gets the second sapiens in the name because some 40,000 years ago, their dimension of quintessence, of being able to vision, was able to vision creatively enough to begin to produce art. And with a sixth dimension of art coming into play, art has this incredible ability to reach back through the open door of vision, back through the open gateway of vision, and prepare so that the doorway is able to be open to many and not just to one. Not just to a select few who are, what, accidents, mutants, geniuses? Art opens the portals, the gateway, by showing that it is not just a window, and it's certainly not a window that is glazed over with a backing of doctrine so that the window becomes a mirror, because all doctrine, all ideology is a glazing on the window of vision, producing a mirror so that the mind only sees itself in what really is a doorway, what really is a window, what really is a gateway, not just a cinematographic mirroring. In the Middle Ages, 1,000 years ago, most learned doctrine books were called speculum this or speculum that. Speculum is the mirror. One looks to see a poignant trigger once pulled in ancient China some 1,400 years ago, when a little kitchen boy named Hui Neg was washing the pots and pans in a monastic community headed by the great fifth patriarch, Matsu, and whose master of the monk's learning, Shenzi, was being prepared to receive the robe and the bowl as the empowering symbols of being the new sixth patriarch of the way in which enlightenment was being passed from lineage to lineage to lineage. And in order to receive that robe and that bowl, one expected that a special poetic quatrain would be written in the Chinese characters. And Shen Hui wrote that without a speck of dust on this mirror mind, one can see very clearly. Coming in the middle of the night morning from his chores. Vuinig, by this time, had learned to read and write, and he was an orphan. And he wrote under it with the little brush that he had and found some ink, and he wrote, "There is no mirror. Wherever is there place where dust could collect?" And getting up very early, Matsu saw Huineg had written this. And when he read it, he brought him quickly into his room, gave him the robe and the bowl, and said, "Now get out of town, because they're all going to be after you, because you do not fit in any way into any order that they can understand and approve and live by. They will not be able to hear you except to ridicule that this is absurd. This is stupidity. This is kitchen boy, pot washer junk. But you are the sixth patriarch." And years and years and years later, when the sixth patriarch's sudden, spontaneous awakening, not a doctrine, not just a technique, but a techne, was recognized by many, many thousands, he delivered what is called the Platform Sutra, which begins that the sixth patriarch came into the vast crowd and ascended the high chair, arranged his robes, and settled in to then speak. And he, in his sutra, it begins with friends, and goes on to tell how he was born. His mother died. He was a beggar on the streets. He became a kitchen helper and finally ended up, and so on and so forth. It is, for the 600s AD, a time when Europe was in what used to be called appropriately the Dark Ages, because the entire classical learning, like a dome of doctrines, had collapsed and had left ruins that were incomprehensible, and with it were swept away incredible amounts of experience and heritage and understanding. But the high dharma combing through way, parayana, is able now to discern quite accurately that that high learning had been sabotaged many times before, and so had not even by the time of about 500 AD, when the collapse actually happened, it was already a collapse of a fault structure, and that's why it collapsed. One of the most poignant qualities after the travesty of World War II, right at the closure, two great discoveries happened at the same time, almost as if they were like a tuned pair. In Egypt, along one of the cliff sides of the Middle Nile, near a village called Nag Hammadi, a group of seven leather folder parchment documents were found, and that is the Nag Hammadi Library that is now world famous. And the other was the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls in a cave by the ancient Qumran monastery that was abandoned in 31 BC because of an immense earthquake that split like a lightning cleaver the stairwell leading down to the baptismal pool of cleansingness for the whole community. And to them, it was an apocalyptic reminder that what they were doing had a fracture in it and was not true. Had come close, but not only no cigar, no more community. No more, because the room enough for a false structure had collapsed. We live at the beginning of 2014 where the false structure has collapsed and it's now apparent. And so what is being presented is not a new teaching, it's not a new ideology. My goodness, it is the parayana that we have been accumulating for a very, very long time, since time itself began. Because helping that zero field emerge spontaneously into an integral, an infinite field cooperates with it and braids together with it, that at the very same time and before there is time, a differential conscious field is playing with the integral egg of the feminine space-time, and this way a cosmos invisibly is always a part of the universe, which is phenomenal, existential, material, ideational, and is only real because of dimensions of consciousness that freely dance and interplay, bringing the aesthetics of beauty and the analytics of truthfulness into a quality which is like a third field, and that is the field of the real. We're looking at something which is startling, because it has not ever been seen except by a very few at the beginnings of where this was first realized, seen, visioned, understood, delivered, and presented. One of the most peculiar qualities is to recognize that there are precursors. And as the event horizon, as the threshold of emergence comes to be, the preludes condense. And as they condense, they also condense with an increased differential conscious energy. And so the time itself becomes time itself. Time herself becomes pregnant with meaning, with dimensions of vision and art, moving into history, into science, into the great complementarity. And when we come back, we'll take a look at a couple of figures who 2,000 years ago were extraordinarily important. One of them is a mysterious figure that no one knows his name. He is called in the Dead Sea Scrolls the Teacher of Righteousness. The other figure is a figure who is well known but has the most mysterious quality of life to him. His name was Ovid, P. Ovidius Naso, Naso. And Ovid was, after Virgil and Horace had died, the greatest poet, the greatest writer in the Roman Empire, and he so offended Augustus Caesar that Augustus Caesar personally banished him to the end of the Roman Empire in the Black Sea to a city then called Tomis, now is called Constanta, and it's in what is now Romania. And he was left there to rot. Not that Constanta or Tomis or the Black Sea is a rotting place, but for Ovid is the greatest writer of that day to be banished to a place where no one could read or write or speak his Latin. It was like sentencing someone to an exile into an ultimate silence. And yet in that silence, Ovid wrote two little documents along with a continuation and completion of a book called the Fasti in Latin, and that is the calendar of how the ritual year keeps the cult of the culture intact so that the doctrines are not disturbed. And he was about to show that all of that is brittle because time is quite different from seasons. That's why Augustus Caesar banished him. And we'll come back and take a look at Ovid and then at the teacher of righteousness who prepared the way between the reference mode and the carrier wave between Alexander the Great and Jesus in Alexandria and Mary Magdalene. Let's take that break. Let's come back. In the images that I put for the handouts of notes each week, for those that donate in some way to the Shared Presence Foundation, which oversees and encompasses all of my work, there's this mosaic of the three magi, which is in the cathedral at Ravenna. Interestingly enough, it's in Ravenna that Dante was banished out of Florence and went to, and a lot of the Divine Comedy and the Vita Nuova, the New Life, was written. These three magi were Persians. They were from Iran. Balthazar, Melchior, and Gaspar, and the cities in Iran where they are from are well known to those who are still able to read and to be able to research. And I have many times referred to them in previous presentations. The three magi brought three gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Notice that triads constantly are appearing, constantly, because the most stable initial form is a triangle. And the most stable form of the triangle is an equilateral triangle. Three angles of 60 degrees each. The whole dimension of a triangle is always the sum of the degrees of the angle totaling 180. What is 180 degrees? Is a straight line in of sphere. The plane of the diameter of a sphere would be a straight line, and as soon as you begin to have shapes one way or the other, you begin to have a triangulation that is even mathematical. It's the very basis of trigonometry. One has to be able to understand what things are and what they're for and not be fooled into thinking that mica is gold. I remember as a boy of 8, we went to Knott's Berry Farm down in Orange County, south of LA, And in those days, you could go into a little streamlet, all the kids with their little pan and pan for gold, and get little specks and flecks of gold, and then they would put them in a little vial with some water and the flecks of gold, and you showed your mom and you showed your dad, I mined for gold. Now it's all about the big rides and the thrills and getting to the panic stage of this or that or the other, and oh, that's really dangerously fun. That's a Hasidic tale of apocalypse. How does the three magi come exactly at the moment of birth, at the place of birth, the birth of someone who is the inheritor of, as the Gospel of Matthew begins, these are the generations of Jesus, son of David, son of Abraham. The lineage is taken back to Abraham through the father, Joseph. And that this Jesus born just now is the 41st generation from Abraham. But in the total, in Matthew, it's 42 generations, because this Jesus reoccurs as a son of himself. Jesus 41 births Jesus Christ 42 through a spiritual birthing called a resurrection. He has a father for that resurrection. And he has a mother, not the mother of the 41st generation, but a mother of wisdom. The counting in Matthew goes back to the time of Abraham, which is about 2000 BC, about 2000 years before that birth with the three magi and Joseph and Mary and the animals together. The whole scene was not even imaginable, not expressible, until about the late 1100s, when a young poetic genius man who sang beautiful songs with a gorgeous voice made the first grouping of them with little figures and bits of straw, and it was called a creche, and that young man was Saint Francis of Assisi, because he could vision accurately and he could see, not with perception, not with conception, wrong, he could see. This is how it played out. And here is the crash for little kids who can still see because they haven't had their mirrors completely glazed by conceptions. They still have the windows. And they still had the ability to see through the looking glass, through the window, like Alice in Wonderland, and see all of this as it is in the play of the real. The Magi are descendants through vision from the original visioner, and that original visioner's name was Zarathustra. In his language, Avestan, his name is pronounced Zarathustra. Ustra is the camel, and Zarat is being the master of, being really good with. And somebody who's the master of camels comes from a family tradition who ran caravans over long enough distances by 2000 BC that they were going all the way from the area that is in Uzbekistan, Samarkand, all the way across all of the huge mountains, the Himalayas, the Pamirs, in across the Gobi Desert, all the way into China. So that Zarathustra, who is a contemporary of Abraham, are a tunable pair of a great threshold that happened about 2000 BC. I call it a carrier wave, because in physics, that's what the acoustic, that's what the energy is called. It's a carrier wave. A carrier wave that has overtones and it has undertones in terms of tonality. But the undertone is really, in physics, a reference wave. So the carrier wave has a reference wave. That's why it can be calibrated in terms of its frequency. And it has overtones that are the capableness of the supra-connectiveness of it. And the word for that, the name for that, was given by Count Louis de Broglie, a great physicist in his time, in the late 1920s, at the 7th Solvay Congress. Solvay Corporation in Brussels was sponsoring these physics meetings every year that they could. And Count Louis de Broglie called them pilot waves, based on the mathematics and the physics of a soliton. A pilot wave is a person who, like a soliton, does not lose their energy through time or space, but continues not just integrally, but continues realistically in terms of the energy carrier, so that what is carried is always that energy. It's always that time. And if the time is real, it is always a real. It's not a present that is real, it's a presence. It's the continuity of the non-present that is the presence of eternity. You probably heard of that. And that life can not only be, quote, present in the world, but it can have presence in eternity. It's actually quite simple, but not hearable when you're grasping to get and not having the open hands of a harmonic. At that birth, 6 months before, 2/3 of a birth cycle of 9 months, was born a relative, like a cousin to Jesus. His name was John the Baptist. John was his name, and he became very famous, even in his own time, as the baptizer. His mother was Elizabeth, and his mother Elizabeth was an older sister to the mother of Jesus, Mary, so that in a way Mary was the youngest sister and Elizabeth the oldest sister, so that John the Baptist was a cousin of Jesus, and this trait, and it is as deep as a trait, means that the cousins of Jesus also were very affine. They had a resonance that was collectible together as a harmonic. And we'll get to that. But in order to preserve the life of Jesus, Mary and Joseph, under the advice of the three magi, who gifted them with enough wealth in small compass, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, so that they could flee and go to another place in chosen self-exile until the danger of murder of all of the infants by Herod the Great, King Herod, was over, because the three magi had interviewed King Herod and had seen through him, had seen that he was decaying through power, decaying through corruption, and that the speed of the decay was such that he was going to be literally a puddling mess within a few years, which he was. And later on, a descendant of his had an accelerated corruption and becoming a puddle mess, was named Agrippa II, who, after he had the apostle St. James beheaded in 44 AD and went to tout his powers of dominating the new prophecies, they went to Caesarea on by the sea, in a outfit that was made of silver bits that were like a quality that when the sun shone on him, he glowed as if he were a spiritual angelic being. And all of a sudden in the ceremony, he fell silent because the dread came upon him. And in a day, he was dead. King Herod died, so jealous of someone taking his power, even though he was old and successful already. That kind of tyranny wants more. Anything that has any kind of a possibility, we want it. There are Russians in Crimea, we want it. Well, there are Russians in Estonia, there are Russians all over the place. Yeah, we want it. You have to understand that it gets serious very fast. But the seriousness is not that shit happens. It's that there is a corruptiveness that allows for the cesspooling of life. That's the apocalyptic thing. And it only comes to a realization when it is impossible for it to go any further, because it already is universally dead. It's a zombie. We live in a world where the zombies outnumber the human beings. And it is time for human beings to become a learning hunting party, hunting learning, and live. That's why all this, ceaseless work. Elizabeth took the baby John out into the edge of the desert, took him to where Qumran used to be. John the Baptist was born just before Jesus, 6 months before he was born in 10 BC. Jesus was born in 9 BC, about the time of Passover. So that the crucifixion resurrection would happen on his birthday in 36. So when he turned 45, he was crucified, and 3 days later, resurrected as the 42nd generation. The precursor of John the Baptist was the teacher of righteousness, who lived a couple of hundred years before, who lived in Alexandria a couple of hundred years before, and lived at Alexandria in a time when it was the most outstanding jewel of learning that humankind have ever had. It was the jewel, the royal jewel, if you wish, of learning. It had inherited, by that time, four generations, including Alexander the Great, who had inherited four generations from himself, from Pythagoras. And when Alexander prematurely died, he was in his early 30s, his childhood friend and one of his top generals, Ptolemy, who also had been educated by Aristotle, just like Alexander had, and several others. Ptolemy chose, in the divvying up of Alexander's empire, to take the site that was planned for Alexandria and to develop it, which gave him the territory then of Egypt. And he's the one that built the vision of Alexandria that Alexander the Great had. It is Ptolemy, he's called Ptolemy I Soter. Soter in Greek is savior. He also remembered and saw to it that Alexander's vision of a great library would be collected, because Aristotle was all about books, because his teacher Plato was all about books, that had learned from Socrates, who was all about learning outside of the books, and yet one can find a way to have the art of putting it into books. And Socrates had learned from a woman named Diotima of the quality of love that allows for a real companionship, because one cannot learn anything whatsoever unless you are friends, companions together. The closest people to Alexander the Great, he called them his companions. What we are doing, we are companions in learning about how to make a new mankind. Not a mankind of kingdoms, however many, however powerful, but of mankind as a single family. The Greek word for it was oikumene, O-E in Greek, E, oikumene in Latin. And the oikumene in Greek, Socrates had learned esoterically from Diotima, who had learned it at the feet of Pythagoras, who is the developer of the original harmonies of music, which apply to the heavens as well, transforming astrology that was a Babylonian thing into a celestial visioning, which was a Pythagorean refinement. So that the Zoroastrian revival and renaissance about the time of Pythagoras, about 500 BC, was a renaissance of something that was there with Zarathustra, 2000 BC. So that one begins to see that there are segments of history, like phases of history, and one can learn to make an analytic that, as Pythagoras said, if you have a string that vibrates and you put a finger in the middle, you get two halves and you get a note which is a half of what the note would have been, and you can continue to do this by making a fret where the string or strings are, and by putting your finger where it is, you can begin to have notes that have a tonality, and that tonality will be able to have pitches, and it will be able to have signature notes where one can understand what the whole note is in a key, and so you begin to have the ability to compose music. And that a really wise, a Homo sapiens sapiens, become a Homo sapiens stellaris, eventually a star wisdom man, understanding our music here is heard everywhere, and there everywhere music can be heard here. Now one has ears to hear. It was about 20 some years ago that the JPL, Jet Propulsion Lab, here in a part of Los Angeles called Upper Pasadena, they made a little whistle that was the sound of the Earth in its orbit around the sun. And eventually, it was understood that each planet would have its own sound, and that there could be such a thing as a tuning flute made of the sounds of the planets. And one could make hearable what before was not even imaginable. That's what is happening here now. In Ptolemy Soter's development, beginning the library, he had one of geniuses, history's great geniuses, a son, and he became known as Philadelphus because he fell in love with his sister, whose name was Arsinoe, who was like him, was an incredible genius. And Ptolemy I become Ptolemy II, Ptolemy I Soter become Ptolemy II Philadelphus, was sent to the island of Kos off the Turkish coast now in the Greek Aegean Sea. Kos is a smaller island, not far from Rhodes, the island of Rhodes. And so in his growing up and his education, Ptolemy Philadelphus became acquainted with Aegean genius. And this is one of the few books on Ptolemy II Philadelphus and his world, a book that costs about $200, published by Brill in Leiden, the Netherlands. There's almost no books on Ptolemy Philadelphus, if you can imagine. There is this one, which is kind of interesting. It's a quality of University of California Press, Theocritus, an encomium of Ptolemy Philadelphus. Because under Philadelphus, he had this beautiful appreciation of the high poetic of language. And Theocritus, the Penguin Classics, publishes his idylls. And his idylls are brilliant pastoral poetry about the coming back not to nature as now an agricultural source of food, a farmland, but coming back to nature and its beauty, that the beautiful in nature gives us the landscape of aesthetic by which our person can emerge from old ideas of self, from old positions of individuality, and begin to participate in the flow of nature, in the ecology of nature, that it's not just cycles that repeat, but it is a continuity that spirals and develops. It both hones and it expands at the same time. A double chirality, a double helix of very special kind. It is the influence of Ptolemy Philadelphus that he recognized that one of the core seed triggers for what he was inheriting and going with was from Pythagoras, and he learned that it was Pythagoras' mother who was the poetic genius, the aesthetic beauty, literally in every word, who birthed and raised Pythagoras. Who, when she fell in love with the father of Pythagoras, named Menasarchus, who ran a shipping company from the coastal city of Phoenicia called Tyre, ancient Tyre, the early Tyrrhenian seagoing things, founded Carthage, they founded what became Marseille, they went through the Straits of Gibraltar out into the Atlantic, and had trade routes as far down as Cameroons and all the way up into the reaches of Spain and into the coastal areas of France. When she came time to being married and to conceive, they went on their honeymoon to Delphi, where the Oracle of Delphi was. And so when she was conceived, she called herself by a new name, Pythias, in honor of the Pythian Apollo of Delphi. And her first son then was called Pythagoras, he of the Pythian Apollo of emanation. All this time, Ptolemy Philadelphus conveyed the energy of all of this to his son, Ptolemy III, Euergetes in Greek. Euergetes means good doing, really good stuff. Euergetes married his sister named Arsinoe II. And just as he was trying to settle in, he fell in love with a woman named Berenice. And Berenice became the great Berenice II, because the original Berenice was the wife of Ptolemy I Soter. And so Berenice II, this is the first book ever on her, just published by Oxford University Press, and the Golden Age of Ptolemaic Alexandria. Ptolemaic Egypt. Her golden age was the culmination of the library growing and growing until in their time, she was the poetic wisdom genius of Alexandria, where the library had a million volumes, scrolls, and had the population that was such a genius that it has powered Western civilization all the way through up to and into the Renaissance. And still today is being discovered for the first time. Berenice II was from Cyrenaica, which is next to Egypt on the coast, it's now Libya, of the Mediterranean Sea, and one of her fellow Cyrenaicans was named Callimachus, who was the greatest poet of that age, of that time, and he was also the director of the library of Alexandria. You have to understand that the overall structure of what was there was called the Museion. The Museion in Greek, in Latin, it's called museum. And the Museum of Alexandria was the place where all of the things were brought, and the library was the learning adjunct to the Musaen. Musaen in Greek means the temple of the muses, the nine muses, who are nine muses that have resonances. And when they are collected, all nine, into a harmonic, the tenth harmonizes the nine muses, and the tenth is Apollo. But Apollo has a sister who is able to convey at the same time as the nine muses, the muse of history, the muse of epic, the muse of music, the muse of epic poetry, and so forth, all of the arts. Apollo makes a harmonic out of the arts. His sister Artemis, who does not marry, but she has all of mankind as the inheritor of her genius. She is the one that is able to nourish through a special high Dharma wisdom what the Apollonian wisdom of the integral is. And she is a master of the differential wisdom of the divine huntress, who doesn't hunt game, but hunts to teach how to hunt for the higher dimensions of things. And her great temple was in Ephesus, on the coast of the Aegean Sea, opposite of Greece, what is the coast of Turkey today. And her temple was the largest temple in antiquity. It was more than 900 feet long. And it's that temple that later became dedicated in a shift, switch, to the Virgin Mary. That's a story worth hearing. But it was there in the Alexandria of Ptolemy III, Euergetes, and Bernice II that was born the teacher of righteousness, into the most brilliant place on the planet ever at that time. And he grew up as a privileged person, a descendant of those translators of the Bible, of the Torah and the prophets, and what would become the wisdom books, from Hebrew into Greek, that Ptolemy Philadelphus had brought originally. And the teacher of righteousness was born into a very special, high-class, very important literary translating tradition where the Greek and the Hebrew were understood as being a twinned pair, because both languages manifested themselves as brilliant written languages at the same time from the same root. And their root was the ancient Phoenician quality of language that eventually became known as Syriac. So that the Psalms of King David in Hebrew are sung to a twin cousin, the hexagramic lines, the hexagonal lines, the hexameter lines of Homer, so that Homer and King David are a pair, 1000 BC, just like Zarathustra and Abraham are a pair, 2000 BC, just like Jesus and Mary Magdalene, who is raised in the Tyre of her age, coming to Alexandria about 8 AD. And it's in 8 AD that Ovid is banished to Constanza in the Black Sea, who had just finished his Metamorphoses, which is the great inspiration for Apuleius's Metamorphosis. And when we come next week, we'll see that in the midst of completing the fasti, the calendar, Augustus Caesar began to understand the import, the immense import, that Ovid, if successful, would pull the plug on the Roman Empire. More next week.